Welcome to Women Leading the Way radio show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations, and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Good afternoon and welcome to Women Lead Radio, brought to you by Connected Women of Influence. I'm Eileen Gaffin, your host for Reputation and Influence. It's a show that explores how women business leaders built their reputation, resilience, and resources to become influential leaders. Our topic today is counterintuitive thinking, new ways of using qualitative engagement to help transform businesses. And our guest today is the amazing Susan Fader. Susan is top in her field. She's an insight navigator, a strategist, qualitative researcher, and moderator. She uses qualitative engagement to get clients unstuck. She's a thought leader in helping businesses reframe how to think about strategic challenges and opportunities and inject innovative research approaches. Good afternoon, Susan.
Hi. Hi there.
I'm so happy to talk to you. You are a rock star in your industry. You're a top influencer and innovator in the field of qualitative research and strategy. And before we get into the actual work itself, how did your career journey begin? How did you get to this point?
It was not something I thought I'd be when I grow up. I don't think most of us end up in careers that we think we're going to be when we're 10. It was more of an evolution. I went to business school. I got my MBA, and it was kind of the world was either went to finance or marketing, and I said, I'll go marketing. And started on the client side as a product manager, then went to an advertising agency, and then moved to Japan and consulted to Japanese companies entering the U.S. And along the way, I discovered research and strategy, and I just fell in love with it. And when we came back from Japan, I started my business. I left the corporate world and started my business and haven't looked back.
And the name of your business, I didn't even give that.
It's Fader Focus.
Fader Focus. And Right. Let's start with the basics, because we've got listeners in all different industries, small business, large. Why do companies use market research? What do they hope to achieve?
They hope to understand many things. It could be they have a product and they want to figure out how to sell or position it. Or they want to explore different ways, opportunities in a category. Or it could be anything. It's where they have a question and they just want an answer. It can be on any topic.
And so when it's an in-house market research department, they may be, maybe they have assumptions about some of their, you know, the answers to some of their questions. Is that a place to start?
So market research is one of those huge terms that really has many things that feed up to it. There's qualitative research, there's quantitative research, there's consumer experience, there's user experience. Qualitative research is people have heard of focus groups or individual interviews. It's where you speak to a limited number of people and you kind of make assumptions and come to conclusions. Quantitative research is where you're speaking to statistical number of people where you can have plus or minus error and you can statistically project. So that's the difference between the two. And then within qualitative researcher, you could be an ethnographer, you could be a user experience, you can be a customer experience. So you could be a sociologist. There are many, many categories under qualitative research.
And so you're one of the leading speakers at conferences, and you do a lot of writing. And what is your role in this space as a qualitative researcher? What is the innovation or thought that you're bringing to this that I know a lot of people want to hear?
So one of the things that all of us, no matter what industry you're in, what there's all this talk about technological innovation and AI and gathering data and data scrubbing. So whatever industry you're in, you're hearing that. But where I focus on is the conceptual part, because what happens, as I feel, and I'll go back to with qualitative, is the focus is we have new technology where we can do this online, and we have an AI program that can analyze the data better. So those, to me, are more executional and analytical. And the soft skills, you know, in terms of communication and thinking, or the conceptual, is where I live. I rethink how you can approach your exploration of trying to get an answer. Because what happens when all this new technology comes out, they take existing ways of doing stuff and just move it onto a platform or integrate it in technology. So I say maybe you have to rethink the baseline assumptions. Maybe you have to start from a different place. And that everything I talk about and write about is really in that area.
Yes, and let's get into that, because I read your article on counterintuitive thinking, and you write about how it's tied to behavioral economics, that people make irrational decisions or they may behave the opposite of what you might think. So I'd love to hear some examples. And if you're trying to solve for a problem, how does counterintuitive thinking come into play?
Okay, so there are two things going there. There's one, which is narrative economics, so if you think about the world of economics, there was classical economics that said people make rational decisions. And then behavioral economics said people don't make rational decisions. And then Richard Schiller, who got the Nobel Prize in 2013, came out with narrative economics. And what I believe just the way market research has taken behavioral economics from the world of economics, we have to take narrative economics. And narrative economics says, my interpretation, we have mm-hmm. to listen to people's stories, because from their standpoint, they might be making a rational decision. So that says to me, if people looking at behavioral economics, it's an outsider judgment that they're making irrational, because for them it might be. Now, getting to counterintuitive thinking, we kind of, you know, when we start a process or we have a business challenge or anything, we have to start somewhere, and usually we default to the same place. So a lot of times if we have a challenge, the first thing we do is we try to find someone with expertise or someone who has a lot of experience, because we feel they can guide us. But the counterintuitive thinking is really, maybe you should use someone who doesn't have that expertise. And the reason I say that is David Epstein, in his book Range, really explains this. There's something called the Eisenlung effect, and he uses a very vivid imagery of experts digging very deep ditches within their expertise. So they have a ditch, it's very wide, they can't look over the side, and they only look for the answer in that ditch. While a mm-hmm. generalist has shallow ditches, they can look over the sides, they find their answers in many different places. And in fact, if you look at the number of patents, the people who have the most patents are generalists, because they have it in many, many different categories, because they can seek answers, they can think outside the box. So that's number one, counterintuitive thinking. Number two is, a lot of times when you have an issue, you either talk to the same types of people, or if you're in another industry, you kind of look for answers under, you know, if you're doing a data search or something, you kind of default to the same terms and everything. And what I'm saying in the example in qualitative research is maybe you need to speak to people who are different. And I did a study on engagement rings, and you would think, of course, you'd speak to people who had bought engagement rings, and, you know, assumption is they're getting married. I spoke to people who had bought engagement rings but broke their engagement, so they were not going to get married. But they had gone through the whole process. And because they were raw and they had gone through this breakup, and they actually were much more introspective and much more willing to share. And we got perspectives that we had never gotten where we had just spoken to people who were, you know, in la-la land, they were getting married.
Yeah, they were in the glow of the engagement moment.
Yes.
Yeah, do you have other examples of how some of this counterintuitive thinking comes to play with how companies have used it?
So another example is, as I said, what I like to focus on is resetting baseline assumptions. So a lot of times you hear, hey, we already know that. We know that. Let's just move on. We don't need to explore that. We have lots of data or lots of experience there. So what I always say is, number one, you might think you know it, but if you're speaking to people, they might not know it. But another thing, you're assuming the world doesn't change. You know, data is backwards looking. You know, it's historical. Data is not forward. It's historical. So things change. And I mean, in the world of COVID, we've seen lightning changes. I mean, there's a famous New Yorker cartoon. Is this the new now of an hour ago, or the new now of a half hour? So we've seen it. It's like time-lapse photography of the last, you know, half year, where before we really weren't aware that change was happening because it was much slower. So an example is, I did a study for a well-known company that has a fabric softener, and they were coming up with new products, and they wanted to start the conversation. They were going to talk to people who were loyal users and their fabric softener and used in nearly every wash. And I said, well, I want to start in a different place. I want to start in the world of laundry because that's where fabric softener resides. And I had the people, before I spoke to them, do self-diagnostic ethnography on themselves, basically observe when they're doing laundry and then identify the three things they like and don't like and then come in and talk about it to me. And guess what? Many of the people didn't even mention fabric softener.
Wow.
They were talking about laundry. So if you're going to have new ideas and concepts and you assume fabric softener is top of mind, you start the conversation there, you're going to get very different reactions to your business proposition. Because I started in the world that this entity existed, the conversation was very different. And the reaction to the concepts was very different. So you have to, again, sometimes you have to reframe and sometimes you have to think differently. And another example is a hotel chain was getting a lot of complaints about slow elevators. And when you think about it, to add another elevator is going to cost, you know, a lot of money. You have to take out, you know, the construction, you have to take out a hotel room. And, you know, people are really complaining. And because the assumption was they were complaining about slow elevators. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was they hated waiting, the wait time. So an easier solution was the hotel just put mirrors around the elevators. You ever wonder why hotels have mirrors around their elevators?
I do wonder that.
It's because people like looking at themselves, and the complaints about slow elevators went away. So that's a classic case of reframing what the problem and what the question is. So that's stepping back. So that's the whole thing of reframing baseline assumptions. Wherever you are, don't assume the problem is what's stated. Step back and just make sure. Look in a bigger context of what's going on with the example I gave you with the fabric softener and laundry.
Yes, because people presumably want answers about their product. I can see why they would start with that, or start with the problem and focus on the problem.
And it's also because they felt they knew that. so we didn't have to. We already know what people think about laundry. We don't want to waste time on that. You know, you hear,
yeah,
we agile, we got to move forward. We don't want to waste time. But sometimes stepping back moves you forward much quicker.
I talked to you a few weeks ago, and you shared with me a medical situation where you actually use a visual concept in getting in listening to the focus group.
So this was a case we were doing with general surgeons, and it was on. I think you're talking about another one. This was with contraceptive that was implantable. And the company thought that they had a messaging problem, that the doctors didn't understand the benefits of prescribing this contraceptive. But with the interviews, I noticed when, because again, I didn't want to start right away. I wanted them to tell me, how do you explain this product to someone who's interested in using it? And I noticed a lot of them touched their rear end, which was kind of strange because this was an implantable that you put in the arm. So I asked them, and they said, well, we know it's the arm, but, you know, what difference does it make? We put it in the tush so that there's no bump, because the women, when they wear their bikinis, they don't want to show. So what happened was, this was an implantable that had to be in the arm, not in the tush. So it wasn't even on anyone's radar screen, but by just observing what they were doing and having that conversation up front, instead of just showing them messages, hey, would this get you more likely to use, I uncovered that they were implanting it wrong.
Whoa, that's a big find. And you were correct. You started to talk about the surgeons. That's the other story I remember. The surgeons, because they were drawing something for you.
Okay. So this was another case where you sometimes think people are all alike and they're really different. So these were general surgeons that did one particular general surgeons generally do 6 to 8 to 10 different surgeries, you know, quite frequently. And these were surgeons who did hernia surgery. And the pharmaceutical company felt that, you know, they're doing 10 plus hernia or 8 plus hernia surgeries a month. We could have one message to them. And it just, based on my experience with medical, it just didn't seem right. So I had a very quick exercise, and this we did in person with 6 doctors at a time. And I gave them a white sheet of paper with a little red heart in the middle, and I said, I know you're not cardiologist, ha-ha, because you have to inject some humor. And I said, write all the surgeries that you like doing close to the heart and ones you don't like far away from the heart. Then circle the 3 you like and the 3 you don't like, and then tell me what they have in common. And it was amazing that these doctors went, oh, my God, that's why I hate hernia surgery. Or, oh, my God, that's why. They hadn't seen a connection across the surgeries they liked and didn't like. And I identified 2 different groups. There were the engineers, the ones who liked the technical and every surgery the same, like a checklist, who really liked hernia surgery, and the general surgeons who were more creative, like breast reconstruction or, you know, things like that, where it was different and challenge, hated it. So you can't really have the same message, even though they're both general surgeons and doing the same amount of the hernia surgeries, they're totally different people.
Their own experiences.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're talking, your messaging is just talking about functionality and this product is better, you're missing half your audience, because they don't want engineering and technical, because they want to be creative, and that it's my skills, my golden hands that are enabling this surgery to go perfectly.
So now that we're 9 months into COVID-19 and the pandemic, Are companies still holding focus groups? Like, how do they do that today? How do they do qualitative research today?
So in the medical field, they're actually they have increased because they're not going to fail. First of all, in pharmaceutical, there's such long timelines you can't stop, but also the budget that they were using for conferences and travel, they're not spending, so they have money for research. Other parts of the industry, some went slow, some went fast. So that's getting back to doing it online. You know, there's Zoom everyone's heard of, but there actually are many market research platforms specifically built so you can do things online. So there are like five of them for focus groups where you can share things with screens. You have multiple, you could preload stuff. So a lot of ways you can do it. And most qualitative researchers, even those who were doing in person, have some experience with online. And then there were ones who only specialized in online. I have been doing online for the past 10 years. So for me to go from, you know, a balance of in-person to online to all online was not an issue because I had the experience of doing it online.
And is it a different experience for the people participating? I mean, are you noticing anything different?
So there are a couple of things. One is people are actually more want to participate more. It's easier to recruit people because people are stuck at home. Your normal interactions with people are not the same. And you know, people just want to talk. However, if you think about it, in person, there's a, you see the person, and online, you're seeing the Brady Bunch or the Hollywood Square, so you just have the head. So you're
True.
Not getting the body language. You also have the issue of in person, if you have a conversation with a group of people, there's a dialogue, you pick up cues, so you don't speak over each other. You can, but you can jump. It's more like a ping pong game. But in online, you don't have those cues, so it's more like around Robin where one person speaks, the next person speaks, the next person speaks. So that dynamic is a little different. So the way I moderate is very different for online than I do in person because you have to keep the engagement and the excitement, and you want to have that cross conversation.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking of small business, entrepreneurs, startups who may not have a budget or access to something like this? Are there alternatives for newer companies or smaller companies that want to learn more about their customer or get insights to their products and services?
So first of all, there are a lot of do-it-yourself platforms. You know, SurveyMonkey with its questionnaires, this is not a focus group, but there are many things out there, and companies are willing to share about their different platforms and what they do. But even if you're a small company, and even if you have a very limited budget, I would highly recommend that you reach out to someone who knows how to do this and tell them what your budgetary constraint is, and maybe you just have them as a consultant and you do it, but this is a skill. You know, there are people who think, well, it's just asking questions. How hard can it be? It's not asking questions. It's the ability to have a conversation, and it's the ability to know how to listen. And it's the ability also to not be afraid of silence. And it's also being able to remember what they said 20 minutes ago. And it's not like we'll get the transcript and then we'll analyze it. You have to be thinking in real time, and that really takes a skill. So even if you're a startup with limited budget, reach out. There are people out there who can help you. And then you might decide to do it on your own, but don't do it on your own because you might make baseline assumptions that start you in the wrong place. And you end up talking to the wrong
people. Yeah, that counterintuitive thinking of maybe someone who doesn't have the expertise that you have.
Well, the expertise, again, it's the ability to step back. like my whole thing is reframing and not, and maybe starting in a different place. So I always start there where you think you're supposed to start. Maybe that's not the right place. And that's something I think a lot of people don't do.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And well, we're getting toward the end of our conversation. And was there one more nugget you want to share with people that you want to make sure when they leave the program today that there's one thing that you want them to remember?
One thing I want them to remember, I guess it's reframing baseline assumptions. Whatever you are, you know, that conceptual part, don't focus so much on the executional and analytical. Make sure the questions and the assumptions you have are the right place to start. Because if you start in the wrong place, you're going to end up in the wrong place.
That whole circle. I know that our listeners may have questions or want to reach you after the show. We've got the link to your website on our radio page, but is there any other way that you want to be contacted if people have any questions?
Sure. There are two ways you can reach me. You can reach me on LinkedIn. Just send me an invite. And the other, and on my LinkedIn page, there's a lot of other articles and webinars, or at Susan Stater at staterfocus.com, and that's F as in Father, A, D as in David, E-R. And you, or you go to my website, www.staterfocus.com.
Well, thank you. That's really great, so that we can reach you if we have questions or want more information. And I just thank you so much for your thoughts and your genius in qualitative research in every which way. I hope you're doing okay during these times.
Thank you. Yes, you too.
Thanks, Susan. That's our show for today. I want to thank Susan Fader for being our guest from Fader Focus, and a special thanks to all our listeners, both in the U.S. and around the world, as we are an international show. We'll be back again for another Women Lead radio show Mondays at 9 a.m. Pacific and Fridays at 2 p.m. And it's been my sincere pleasure to be your host today. Remember, your reputation is our business.
Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence, the premier private membership organization where like-focused business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.